When it comes to scents, you should pick ones that smell like, well, you. Target gets it, which is why they offer a range of personal care products with fragrances for everyone. Be true to floral you with Dove Peony and Rose Body Wash. Live your fresh life with Degree Ultra Clear Deodorant. Express your decadent side with Love Beauty and Planet Coconut Shampoo. This spring, choose care that brings you joy beyond labels. Pick up new favorites at a Target near you or online at Target.com.
Tonight on The Readout.
Hey everybody, it's RNC co-chair Lara Trump. If you can't afford a donation today, I ask that you would save it for a later date. But if you can donate even as much as $5, it will go a long way.
Yeah, you don't need that money. The never-ending Trump grift. As daughter-in-law Lara Trump tells MAGA supporters, please give us your last $5. As Donald takes yet another shot at trying to kill his New York hush money trial. Also tonight, the RFK Jr. factor. Some say he'll take votes away from Biden. And yet, some of his big donors are tied to far-right extremists, Christian nationalists, and even January 6th insurrectionists. Plus, the Biden economy, yet another month of blockbuster job growth, which even Fox struggled to give a negative spin. Although, of course, they tried. But we begin tonight hoping everyone is okay on the East Coast following that 4.8 magnitude earthquake in the New York tri-state area, plus the aftershock like about 20 minutes ago. Now, if I didn't know any better, I would expect that Donald Trump is calling up his lawyer to see if there was any damage done to the Manhattan criminal courthouse in hopes that it might delay his impending hush money criminal trial that is set to start in just 10 days. That's because nothing else that Trump has tried has been able to stop this trial from getting underway. And believe me, he's been desperately trying. Today, Trump followed through on his latest Hail Mary pass, just hoping he can buy some more time before having to face a jury who could hold him accountable for his actions and turn him into the first presidential felon. His legal team filed a 37-page motion calling for Judge Juan Marchand to recuse himself. And that might sound familiar because they already tried that once before, last year, with a main factor being Marchand's daughter's work as a Democratic political consultant. And to no one's surprise, the majority of this motion is focused on her as well, with Trump's lawyers starting to use her name in the second sentence of the motion. But before we get to his latest gripe session, let's remind everyone what happened the first time that Trump tried this tactic. Marchand did not step down last year, but he showed that he took Trump's motion seriously. In his decision denying the motion, Marchand cited guidance he sought from the state court system's advisory committee on judicial ethics, which wrote in regard to Marchand's daughter that this case does not involve either the judge's relative or the relative's business, whether directly or indirectly. They are not parties or likely witnesses in the matter, and none of the parties or counsel before the judge are clients in the business. We see nothing in the inquiry to suggest that the outcome of the case could have any effect on the judge's relative, the relative's business, or any of their interests. So what has changed since then? According to Trump's lawyers, the main difference now is that Trump is the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. And as such, Marchand's daughter could see financial benefits from developments in Trump's trial. They claim it would create, quote, fodder for fundraising for her Democratic clients, which her company would then make money on through their work. They also claim that since their last recusal request, Marchand's daughter deleted one of her social media accounts that contained posts reflecting hostility toward Trump. And somehow that would be grounds for Judge Marchand to recuse himself. We are now waiting for Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office to file their reply to Trump's recusal motion and ultimately see what Judge Marchand does the second time around on this issue. But as I've said, as the clock ticks down toward April 15th, Trump is looking for something, anything, to try to make all of it stop, even refiling past motions for delays or perhaps hoping for another earthquake. Joining me now is Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney, professor at the University of Alabama Law School, and MSNBC legal analyst. And Jelani Cobb, dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, staff writer for The New Yorker, and MSNBC political contributor. Thank you both for being here. Joyce, I'll let you start. What do you think are the merits of this motion?
I don't think it'll end up being meritorious, but I think you hit the key point, Joy, which is that when the first motion to recuse was filed, the judge took it seriously. He didn't just go through the motions. He actually went to an ethics committee. And this is a resource that all judges have, federal and state, some form of advice from ethics experts who, when a conflicts issue arises, they can go and get an opinion from the people whose job it is to study these issues. The judge did it the last time. He might even do it again here. But ultimately, this decision should be something that we see from him very quickly. And I don't expect he'll leave the case unless there's more here than meets the eye.
You know, just from a journalism point of view, Jelani, you know, we have to go through what I just did. That we have to recite, and you know, it's a motion that's been duly filed. He has the right to do it under the law. But we all know underlying it, it's the same thing they tried with the Fannie Willis, you know, that she's going to make somehow money because she's dating the guy that works with her, mm-hmm. right? We know it's BS, mm-hmm. but we have to go through the motions. And just talk about that as kind of, because this to me does fall into the how do you cover Trump world, does it not?
Oh, sure. It absolutely does. And so, I mean, I think there's a thing that you have to treat all of this with a kind of professional diligence.
Yeah.
You know, even on the judicial side, certainly on the journalism side. And beneath that, you know, there's also a kind of recognition of what this is, which yeah. is, you know, to make a boxing analogy, there was an old tactic that you sometimes see boxers do when, you know, they knew they were losing, which was just to try to tie up the opponent.
Lay on them. Yes, I'm a huge boxing fan. You don't spoke my language here.
Just keep hugging
yes,
the person
until
the bell rings.
Yes.
And in this case, the bell is the November election.
Yeah.
And the hope is that if you can throw enough things, enough obstacles, enough kinds of, you know, political, or rather legal motions, this thing will drag out. But I think that we have to, on the journalism side, we have to give the facts that are happening.
Yeah.
And also the context around it so people get a sense of, like, why this is happening.
Why it's happening. And Joyce, I guess the question is, how long does the judiciary have to do that? Right? I mean, they have to take these motions. They have to accept them. They have to go through the motions. But is it possible? Because this is Trump's last ditch attempt. He doesn't want this trial to happen because clearly his pollsters are probably telling him that if he goes through this case, which isn't going to take, you know, a year, and he's then found guilty, he's then a felon. And that's going to impact his ability to add to his coalition, to get independents to vote for him. There's lots of evidence that people have said they won't vote for him if he is a felon. How long does the judicial branch of our government have to keep going through this? At what point can they say this is frivolous? Stop.
Yeah, so I think any judge who wants to and who's paying attention appreciates that Trump is now at that desperate stage of last-ditch, often not meritorious motions. But something that I think is tough for people when they look at Trump to wrap their arms around is this notion that judges have an obligation that has nothing to do with politics. They have an obligation to give every defendant, even and perhaps especially Donald Trump, the due process that we're entitled to. So this judge might have been well within his rights to not hear a second motion for recusal. You know, when you make a request to recuse, you don't get to keep filing it over and over. If you lose, you can raise it on appeal if you get convicted. But the judge is being conscientious here because there are some new grounds, some additional circumstances, and he will give it a hard look. But I think what's changing with most of the judiciary is that they are ruling more quickly. They are not bending over backwards to give Donald Trump, you know, the benefit of every doubt. This is a judge who looks like he is serious about getting this case to trial on
yeah.
time.
But and the other thing that's different about this, Jelani, is that we're also talking about the judge's family, mm-hmm. his daughter. And Donald Trump is being very relentless about the fact that he is going to keep naming this young woman who has nothing to do with this case. He's going to keep calling out her job, what she does for a living, and naming her, shaming her, and honestly trying to get her targeted. It's a repeated pattern. He's done it with Fannie Willis. He's done it with Letitia James. At a certain point, we're talking about somebody who is a danger to people.
Well, I think there's another kind of theme here, which is that every legitimate process by which he has been accountable or anything that he doesn't like, he has made to seem illegitimate, or he's tried to paint it as illegitimate. Mm-hmm. And the way that you do that is to say that he's being unfairly targeted. This is what happened in the Iowa caucuses in the 2016 election. This is what happened on January 6th in the 2020 election. And now we've seen it in subsequent every institution. Journalism is biased. You know, anything that has come out that has been unfavorable to him.
Yeah.
I think this is the latest strand of that that we're seeing, but it's part of a very established pattern. Mm-hmm. And I will give you two historical footnotes here while we're talking. James Michael Curley, 1946, mayor of Boston, ran for re-election while indicted and actually won, served part of a prison term while in office, and appointed another person as a caretaker and came out, resumed the mayorship.
Wow.
And 1912, Eugene Debs ran for president while arrested, while behind bars, received about almost a million votes, which was the highest that any socialist candidate had ever received.
Right.
Those were the only two examples I could come up with when I was trying to rack my brain about what happens with political figures who have been indicted, who are still running for an office.
Yeah. And so what happens here? Because it is a big question, Joyce. I don't believe he'll spend a day. I can't imagine, you know, him actually serving time, although I guess he could. In theory, in this case, it would be a felony. What do you think the prospects are that Donald Trump will join this this very notorious, very brief list that Jelani has given us of historical figures who've served time and also served in office?
So, look, I spent a lot of time as a prosecutor, Joy, 25 years, and something that you learn is that the dynamic shifts after there's been a conviction, after a jury pronounces their decision that someone is guilty. The only thing left to consider at that point is what the sentence should be. And at that point, this sort of gravitas that Donald Trump has tried to wrap himself in, you know, this I'm a political candidate sort of line that he uses, that really drops off. And the judge is simply looking at issues involving the conduct and the sort of sentences that are given to other defendants for conviction under this provision. This is a bread and butter statute that the district attorney in Manhattan uses. People do go to prison when they're convicted of felonies under this statute. And I think Donald Trump becomes defendant convicted felon Trump at that point in time. He's no longer cloaked as President Trump.
And the thing that, you know, he keeps on trying to say is that this is a two-tier justice system. Yes, it is. I can't imagine any other defendant being able to be given this much leeway, this many appeals, this many ways out that he's had. He is being super privileged. The way he's being treated is sui generis. There is no other American who could get away with it. He's actually being treated better.
Well, I mean, I think the question, the fundamental question we should be thinking about in that regard is why none of this happened in the years before he entered politics. And so the kind of impunity that you know, attended his long business career for very many decades, while you know the New York Times did that tremendous reporting about the taxes and the various kinds of you know inconsistencies, we should say, in the tax record.
He and his father.
But these are things that were going back somehow. That never generated any serious legal jeopardy for him in those years before.
Yeah.
And so the impunity goes way back before the presidency.
One wonders why that is. I think we could make a guess, but if we did, we'd probably be accused of doing CRT or DEI. Yeah. And, you know, that's a bad thing now. Joyce Vance and Jelani Cobb, thank you both very much. Up next on The Readout, it's bad enough that a leading anti-vaxxer who has spread bigoted COVID conspiracy theories could doom Biden's reelection bid. Turns out his campaign is still flirting with far-right extremism as well. That's next. Okay, we need to talk about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the independent presidential candidate who could imperil President Biden's reelection chances and hand the White House to Donald Trump. Which is weird, right? Since a lot of his positions, plans, and fans are straight out of the MAGA playbook. Take his latest exploits. His campaign disavowed its own fundraising email calling January 6th the defendants activists. In the appeal sent to supporters, the campaign said, quote, "This is the reality that every American citizen faces, from Ed Snowden to Julian Assange to the J6 activists sitting in a Washington, D.C. jail cell stripped of their constitutional liberties." Now, it's worth noting that Julian Assange, who is Australian, not American, faces extradition for violating the Espionage Act. And Edward Snowden sent himself into exile in Russia after leaking U.S. national security secrets. RFK Jr.'s campaign said calling the people who stormed the Capitol activists was an error. That doesn't reflect his views. But it is part of his core argument for why he claims President Biden is more dangerous than Donald Trump. He's pretty consistently downplayed January 6th, once calling it an obsession of Democrats.
Or it was more dangerous to our republic. All these, you know, the yahoos who invaded, you know, that building on January 6th, which, by the way, what's the worst thing that could happen, right?
To me, it's much more serious if we're starting to censor free speech. You can rebuild a capital. You know, if you eliminate the Constitution, there's really nothing left in America.
What's the worst thing that could happen? Hang Mike Pence? I can't believe I have to say this. But these weren't just bumbling yahoos who got caught in a crowd. They were violent, and many of them were armed. One of them is charged with stabbing an officer with a flagpole. Another with attacking officers and launching an explosive device into a tunnel. And today, Kennedy put out a statement on January 6th that didn't really dispute his previous comments, saying, among other things, I have not examined the evidence in detail, but reasonable people, including Trump opponents, tell me there is little evidence of a true insurrection. Because to RFK Jr., the real danger isn't the people who tried to obstruct an official proceeding to overthrow our democracy and hang Mike Pence. It's that the Biden administration encouraged social media companies to take down his anti-vax lies and nonsense. He was particularly upset about one particular flagged tweet. It suggested, with zero evidence, that baseball legend Hank Aaron died at age 86 from the COVID vaccine. The tweet was never actually taken down. He's also mad that he was banned from Instagram for repeatedly sharing debunked claims about COVID and vaccines. Getting more riled up about social media free speech than about mass COVID death or an actual coup attempt has made Kennedy quite popular on the far right. And his candidacy was reportedly encouraged by all the worst Trump world people. Robert Costa of CBS News reported last year that Steve Bannon spent months encouraging Kennedy to get into the race, believing that he could be both a useful chaos agent in the 2024 race and a big name who could help stoke anti-vax sentiment around the country. Kennedy denied ties to Bannon. There's also the other part where he's gotten money from Trump supporters. Reclusive billionaire Tim Mellon has spent millions donating to his campaign and previously spent millions on Trump. Today, David Korn reports for Mother Jones on some of Kennedy's fundraisers. Steve and Tracy Slepchevic hosted a fundraiser for Kennedy last month, but the personal politics of the Slepchevics illuminate the weird currents propelling Kennedy's White House bid. Since the pair have hobnobbed with QAnoners, Christian nationalists, election deniers, and other pro-Trump extremists. And David Korn joins me now. He is Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones and an MSNBC political analyst. David, tell me about the Slepchevics.
Well, they are a couple who have been involved in all sorts of far-right, usually pro-Trump activity. She is an anti-vaxxer as well. She's worked with Kennedy and his nonprofit anti-vax operation.
That tracks.
He was at January 6th. He was at the Capitol. No evidence he was inside the Capitol, but he was posting, this is a staged event. No one's storming the Capitol. That's just fake news media. There are photos from that time of him posing with three percenters. These were militia guys, two of whom in the picture ended up being convicted for their participation in the January 6th riot. And it goes on from there. She's a part of the Reawaken America tour. I'm sure you spent many hours at these events that featured QAnoners, Michael Flynn, Alex Jones, Laura and Eric Trump, all pushing the most far-right Trump and conspiratorial agenda there is on the far right.
Yeah.
So again and again and again, and looking at their recent pasts, mm-hmm. we see this tremendous intersection between them and, of course, the anti-vax movement, but the Alex Jonesian QAnon world of the far right. And as you quoted, to me, what was really interesting about this is that this just illustrates some of these very weird currents that are pushing Kennedy's campaign, you know, down the road. We talked about Steve Bannon, and Roger Stone has been a big mm-hmm. fan of his. And, you know, the campaign would not comment on their involvement or how much they raised for him or whether they'll be raising more money. Steve Slepchevic also has his own rocky business career. He was arrested in 2009 for defrauding Hurricane Katrina victims, but he was arrested, but the case was dismissed.
Right.
But so I don't want to call anybody, you know, a grifter, but they certainly are part of this very weird far right, which is out of sync with some of the previous positions that Kennedy has taken in favor of the environment, in favor of working class programs and things like this. And with those comments that you quoted, including the one that he made, which he called the J6 protesters, he called them demonstrators as well. They're just demonstrating.
Just demonstrators.
And then when he said the other day that Biden is a worse threat than Trump, it shows that he's really seems to be working in that far right Trump lane. He doesn't say anything negative
about Trump.
And I can, you know,
he's about Trump. I mean, the reality, and it kind of explained. It's a weird thing because they're just going to put up the poll. He's taking at the moment equally, I guess, in some polls from both.
Yeah.
But the question of why anyone on the Democratic side would be interested in him, because he is clearly an anti-vaxxer. He's somebody who seems to me that Bannon would see as a better version of Jill Stein, more well-known than Jill Stein, but who could do the same damage to Biden.
Yeah.
How do we explain, you know, he's like pro-crypto? Are these the things that he's using to pull in people from the left?
It's kind of hard to figure out what his strategy is, because what he's been saying recently is all that Biden is bad, the left is
because
bad.
Because they won't let him do anti-vax stuff.
Right, because they censored him for the disinformation he was putting out and the conspiracy theories he was putting out, calling Dr. Fauci one of the worst people in American history. And so all that seems to be addressed towards
He's against the MMR vaccine. He's against all of it.
But he also lies about it. That's the thing. He has all these crazy notions, and he'll go on just recently and said, I've never said I was anti-vax. And then within moments on Twitter, you get this clip from a podcast from last July when he said there's no such thing as a safe and effective vaccination.
He's also said things like video games and the drugs people give for ADHD are the reason of mass shootings, not guns. I mean, and on Israel, people may be drifting toward him for that. He's farther to the right than Biden on Israel. Way farther to the right.
Yeah, he's insulted the Palestinian people, saying they're the most pampered people around.
Yes.
And let's go to 9/11. Because just recently, Chris Cuomo was asking him, you have a lot of wacky ideas, including 9/11. He says, I've never said anything about 9/11. Three, two, one. And there's a podcast in which he's pushing a conspiracy theory about the collapse of Building 7.
Absolutely. Let me give it one last thing. No Labels has gone away. They've tried everything. They tried to get Chris Christie, Nikki Haley, Larry Hogan, Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, Liz Cheney. They even tried The Rock. What happened?
We've been talking about this for 6 months now. It was a dumb idea.
Yes,
you know, their theory of the case was that they could magically find a unity ticket of Republican and Democrat that would just excite the public and they would just win easily. But when they started saying that Joe Manchin was their guy, that was the tell.
Manchin.
I mean, Manchin, whatever you think about him, he's not someone that the American public is yearning to put in the White House.
Maybe if they'd gotten The Rock. David Corn, thank you very much. That would have been fun. Thank you very much, my friend. Much appreciated. Okay, coming up, after just 4 days, Israel's military, just 4 days, has concluded its entire investigation into the airstrikes that killed 7 aid workers in Gaza, saying the strikes were carried out in serious violation of military operating procedures. World Central Kitchen has hit back, saying, well, that is not good enough. Stay with us. There is a very, shall we say, expected outcome when an organization investigates itself. Say when a military clears itself of committing war crimes, or when a police department clears its own cops of shooting an unarmed black man. Nothing to see here. We have determined we are innocent. Moving along. Today, Israel's military released findings of its own investigation of the fatal attack on a World Central Kitchen humanitarian convoy that killed 7 aid workers. The findings were released in a 7-paragraph statement, and only 4 days after the attack. Pretty swift for an incident of this magnitude and the impact it's had on world public opinion. The findings from the IDF's investigation of itself concluded that the attack was the result of errors and was contrary to military procedures, and that those who approved the strike were convinced that they were targeting armed Hamas operatives and not WCK employees. 2 officers will be dismissed and commanders reprimanded, essentially a slap on the wrist.
World Central Kitchen had stronger words, demanding the creation of an independent commission to investigate the killings of its colleagues, saying, quote, "The IDF cannot credibly investigate its own failure in Gaza. Israel's killing of the aid workers could very well be the tipping point for President Biden, who told Prime Minister Netanyahu that the U.S. policy hinges on Israel's immediate action. We're still waiting to hear what Israel plans to do with that ultimatum. So far, Israel has committed to use Ashdod port to directly bring in food assistance and open crossings to get aid into Rafah and, critically, northern Gaza, where the hunger is most dire. But here, closer to home, President Biden has his own party to contend with. Biden allies in the Senate are piling on the pressure to halt Israel aid over its conduct of the Gaza war. This includes Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, a longtime supporter of Israel and one of Biden's closest Democratic allies in Congress. And joining me now is Ahmed Khan, human rights advocate and a former Biden donor. Ahmed, thank you for coming back. I want to ask you what you make of this investigation and its speed.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for having me back on. Well, first and foremost, I'd like to emphasize that since October 8th, there have been over 100,000 casualties of Palestinians in Gaza. Casualties are murders, deaths, and injuries. And what we'll find on the day we finally get investigations and reports into all of those will be very similar to what the reality is with regard to the targeting and murder of the World Central Kitchen staff. Now, in terms of the report, as you mentioned, it was produced rather quickly, and the speed of it shows. It's shoddy. So anyone with any background in this field can poke plenty of holes in this report. And I want to preface that by saying I've been doing humanitarian relief deliveries into war zones for every major war of the last 20 years, and unfortunately, I've been in similar situations, and you know, luckily I've survived them. In this case, the relentless bombing was worse than anything I've ever seen. So, you know, about the report, we could go into any number of things, and I could you know bore you to death. But basically, the IDF has had a problem with a process called command and control for years and years. And command and control is, you know, according to the U.S. Field Army manual, the process of overseeing, for example, fire missions. And to anyone who's delivered aid in any of the occupied territories, they're very familiar with that. The IDF will basically pretend to take coordinates. Some department within the IDF will have the coordinates, and very often they just won't pass them on to the relevant operational command. And that's somewhat mentioned in the report, and I think I raised that with you earlier as one of the issues, or one of the many, many issues. And when investigations are done into the murder of Palestinian civilians, we'll find out that there were issues with command and control with regard to operational command in the field, commanders having the ability to just fire at will. Another problem is they claim that they couldn't see. Now, that's something called intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And I can tell you that they can see. I'm very familiar with what the drones are capable of at night or day from any distance. And they very much can see the logo on top of the car. They can see, they know who's in the car. And that's just devastating. And, you know, I can go on.
Yeah.
For example, I've had the chance to review some of the text messages Damian Sobel sent some of our mutual friends over the last couple of weeks. And
tell us who Damian Sobel is.
Damian Sobel is the Polish World Central Kitchen staffer. Very, very experienced. He had delivered aid in many, many countries, and I was familiar with his work in Ukraine as we were there at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so he had actually reiterated to many of our mutual friends and colleagues just the lengths that they go to inform the IDF of their movements. And they were very clear that they would never actually move anywhere near Gaza City without informing the IDF, you know, so informing their counterparts at the IDF. Now, what the IDF did with that information, we really don't know. So, you know, there are many problems with this report, but there are actually many problems with the operations of the IDF on a daily basis. And that's what comes out when this happens. And it's a tragedy that it happens. It's also a tragedy that, again, the 100,000 casualties haven't sort of raised these alarms with the lack of command and control, the lack of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance.
At the same time that that's happening, I will note that Prime Minister Netanyahu did meet with Republicans on Thursday to reiterate his opposition to a two-state solution and to ask that more money be sent and sent more quickly. If that does happen, more money sent more quickly, and this was after the airstrike, he also reiterated that he will do anything to stop a Palestinian state from coming into being. What do you make of that statement in light of this report?
Well, I mean, you know, he's calling for more money and more weapons. They literally have everything. You know, they have Apaches, they have Reaper drones, they have Predator drones, they have just about everything you could possibly ever need. So it's a bit difficult to take that seriously.
Thank you very much, Ahmed Khan, and we appreciate you. Thank you for coming back, and we'll have you come back again, hopefully. Thank you. And up next, Bidenomics sends a tremor through the job market. You see what I did there? Stay with us. To hear freshly unmarried Christian fundamentalist Marjorie Taylor Greene tell it, the earthquake that most of us felt on the East Coast was the result of God's wrath for our sins. Or maybe it was the result of the blockbuster jobs report out this morning that showed 303,000 new jobs were added in March instead of the 200,000 that were expected. That news left the folks over at the Fox Comfy Couch shook.
Unemployment rate unexpectedly drops from 3.9%, which was a two-year high, to 3.8%. Immediate reaction in the market. Maria, I am seeing futures moving a little bit higher, and that's all I'm getting at the moment. I'm trying to get my rates, but they're stronger than expected at the surface report.
We're looking at a market that is up, but off of the highs, okay? We're losing steam, and we're losing steam fast.
We're losing steam fast. Joining me now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC chief correspondent and host of Velshi on MSNBC.
Christina Greer.
He is literally fresh into the studio. Christina Greer, political scientist and host of the Blackest Questions podcast. I've been on that. And Susan Del Percio, Republican strategist and MSNBC political analyst. And she still allows herself to be called a Republican. So we love that. Ali Velshi, you're up, sir.
They were sad.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, you didn't play this part, but Maria actually said, the economy's strong, but is it too strong?
Is it too strong?
Right? I mean, it is what it is. So, you know, when you cover these things, some months it'll be good, some months it'll be bad. The interesting thing is usually when you get a strong employment report, stocks go down because business owners think, they're going to demand more wages and all that. It's very hard to parse this economy and find the systemically broken parts.
Yeah.
It's just a good economy.
Yeah.
And this is tough for people who don't want it to be so.
So then the question is, let's talk the politics of it now for the Democrats and Republicans. For the Republicans, what are the politics of it? They can't say the economy's bad. It's not.
They can't. Well, they shouldn't. Let me rephrase.
Oh, okay.
They should not. But it won't stop them. And they'll say inflation. Mm-hmm. And here's the part that's hurting the Democrats is that there still is a narrative out there that the economy is not strong. And now add that we're seeing certain things that don't fall into the inflation index, like gasoline and housing costs, that are still going up and people feel it. So people are still feeling a harder economy, even though they're doing better. But I do believe it's all going to catch up in a couple of months because the economy is that strong that people are going to be like, oh, wait, we're all kind of doing pretty
well,
good.
Well, we drove in today, okay? My husband and I drove in today. My husband, brother, and I, we were all in the car. And as we're driving, all you see is the Biden bucks being spent all over. You see infrastructure projects going from here, from, you know, from Maryland to D.C. It's Biden bucks being spent everywhere. You can't go in an airport without seeing all of the spending. So at some point, does it catch up? Because it's true. Housing costs are still an issue. Mm-hmm. And look, billionaires buying up housing and then re-renting it is kind of an issue. But housing costs and affordability is still a problem.
Right. But when we talk about the economy, the average American doesn't really know what the economy
is. That's a
good point. They go to the polls because of pocketbook issues. Mm-hmm. So are my groceries more expensive?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Does gas cost $4 versus $3? You know, is my rent going up? Mm-hmm. Are my wages keeping up with these things? I think the problem with the Biden administration is the same thing we saw with the Obama administration. Work is getting done.
Yeah.
Progress is there. But the articulation that all this infrastructure building that you're seeing, all these new jobs, I did this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can't keep relying on Pete Buttigieg to go on Fox News to articulate your vision. Right? And you need to name it something. Remember Barack Obama's America Rediscovery Back to Work Act? I mean, no one knew what it was. But instead of something that's simple, the New Deal, the Great Society, like, let's
or
name
Donald
it.
And Trump, who said, I made it better.
Yeah, or the stimmy, it's like the things that
stimmy check.
Yeah,
that's
stimmy
it,
check.
Right?
That's all.
Whether it's true or not. And so Joe Biden and his allies, associates, and surrogates need to be clear and articulate what they have done, what they are doing, what they will do.
Yeah.
Those three things in triumvirate. And just make it very clear.
Very clear and simple.
When someone says, I don't know, you know, what have they done for me?
It's like, you can answer
very clearly, this is what they've done.
But here's the question, because I am kind of obsessed with this. The question of how much of what we experience as inflation is actually greed. Like, how much of it is profit taking?
Yep.
How much of it is billionaires buying up housing and re-renting it?
We've seen
how
it.
Much of
we've
it?
Seen it. That all of that is true. And we've seen companies, because last year there was this furor about theft in shops. Shrinkage and all that.
Yeah.
Lo and behold, I think Costco came out at the time and said, we're not seeing this. Now everybody come out and said, we're not really seeing it.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have make up costs because people were stealing things off the shelves. When prices go up, once you get society used to the fact, whether they like it or not, the prices are going up, then prices go up. So your local shop in your local restaurant, their prices are going up because wages are going up. But everybody thinks prices are going up so you can get away with it.
Yeah.
Right, but here's the kicker is that when the president put out the Inflation Reduction Act, that translates into prices going down. Prices don't go down.
You've actually got something wrong with you.
Right. Except for supply chain issues.
Yes.
I'll put that aside.
Correct.
But so that in lies part of the problem with the messaging is that people expected prices to go
down. Let me tell you one thing that is going up. Well, eggs are always going up. I have to play this because the price of my pillow's gone up because now you have to include a donation. I have to play this Lara Trump sound. Take a look.
$25 extravaganza. Two-pack multi-use MyPillows, just $25. MyPillow sandals, $25. Their six-pack towel sets, you guessed it, $25. Their new four-pack dish towels, $25.
Is the whole chair.
Yeah.
Right. Is that real? Is that for real?
Yes.
No, this is, I mean, but, you know, we laugh, but it's our democracy. We laugh, but, you know, Donald Trump and his sycophants are inching closer and closer to the White House if we aren't clear about the vision that Biden is putting forward. I mean, the fact that we have family members now running the RNC, we would always say, like, look at those other countries. That's
a
ridiculous.
Little, yeah, that's a little other country.
It's a little other country.
But we've always, you know, sort of had a myth about who we are as a nation.
Right. Yeah.
And Donald Trump has exposed that. I mean, he's shown that the emperor has no clothes. And so now that we have his daughter-in-law running the RNC, it may not work out for them the way they planned, but if it does, we're in a really dangerous
situation. If he gets back in, you might have to swipe your card to get into the White House. Like, I can see, like, that might be the way it has to go.
I never thought I would talk so much about foam pillows in my life, but this guy keeps coming back. Huh?
And they're actually crap pillows.
They're great. Yeah, they're just a bad foam pillow.
They're a bad foam pillow. But let's talk a little bit about this idea of renaming Dulles. Now, Dulles is not the best airport. It might be the worst airport in America. The Republicans are like, let's name it after Donald Trump. I love the fact that it's named after one of the most diabolical secretaries of state who destroyed Iran. And much of Central America.
But let's make that worse.
But let's make it worse. Well, so the Democrats have said, let's name a prison after Trump. Thoughts, name a prison in Miami.
That is a fantastic
one. Bernie Kerik has one.
Bernie Kerik has a prison?
Named after him? Yes, what? I had to remove it when he went to jail. But yeah, it was a New York
before
City
he went to
jail. Kerik prison. But it was up there for a while.
I was wondering, when you see like hospital wings named after people, the person has to go to the hospital. They get to talk about that all the time.
Do they get to talk about it?
I wonder if it's the same thing with prisons.
Well, I think this is a great opportunity for the nerds at the table just to talk about Alan Dulles and also his brother. It was John Foster Dulles, I think, and Alan Dulles. And both of them were involved in destroying Guatemala and Iran.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's important, and that's given me the opportunity.
Well, I mean, they've already renamed National Reagan, which I refuse to call Reagan.
I just call it DCA.
But I do think that the naming of airports and institutions is really important. And so, something like Dulles, as we rethink the naming of certain institutions, it's a very valid conversation for us to have. But Donald Trump, because he's still an active member in politics, but he's also still an active client or defendant in several court cases across several states, I don't think we should be having that conversation.
At all.
I would much rather, honestly, we both have ties to Florida. I would much rather the Florida Democrats focus up, maybe think about how you can deliver Florida for the Democrats in 2024 and get a governor in
super
there.
Super fair. All right, Allie, Christina, and also Susan. It's a hostage situation times three. They're sticking around to tell us who won the week. But first, this Sunday, MSNBC Films presents Cancel, the story of cancel culture. Here's a clip from the latest installment of the Turning Point documentary series from executive producer Trevor Noah.
We didn't have a problem with cancel culture when it was only the powerful people canceling the powerless. It's only when the people who used to be punched down upon start punching back, all of us think, there's a cancel culture. This is awful. This is awful.
What's the issue here? Is the issue when people of color start talking back, when women start talking back, and that's cancel culture? No, that's free speech. That's actually the freest kind of speech. You're actually getting a back and forth.
Oop. Canceled airs this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC. Definitely gonna watch that. We'll be right back. Okay, friends, we made it to the end of another week. A little shaky, but we made it, which means it's time to play our favorite game. You see what I did there. Who won the week? Back with me are Allie, Christina, and Susan. Allie, who won the week?
Shut the clock, 15 seconds.
Hold on now. Watch out now.
Go read Medgar and Merle, an amazing book. I've still got my highlights in there. And the rest of it is the earthquake. Yes. Because for a few minutes today, those of us in New York and up and down the East Coast, but particularly in New York, stopped talking about crime, rats, subway evasion, and the remarkable increase in violence that everybody talks about around here. So, yeah, the earthquake got us a few minutes.
I love it. I love it. Christine, who won the week?
Well, all my students have to have two favorite cities, one in the U.S. and one internationally. My favorite U.S. city is Baltimore. And so I'm going to say Mayor Brandon Scott.
Come on,
he's held it down. Be more.
Yes.
The Charm City. He held it down. And the city is going to sort of stay strong. And obviously we'll figure out infrastructure. But he's been great.
I love that. Okay. It's up to you, Susan DelPersia. Who
so the Florida Supreme Court came down with two rulings this week. I'm going to focus on the good one. The bad one was basically banning abortion in Florida.
Yeah.
But there will be a constitutional amendment on the ballot that they really fought hard for. And the people of Florida can change it. And I think they will.
So I have decided that who won the week? The women of the NCAA. Nobody cares about the men's.
Right.
They just care about the women. And Baltimore Strong. Angel Reese, also from Baltimore. Caitlin Clark, Juju Watkins, Paige Beckers, you name it. These sisters were balling. Some of them are about to get into the WNBA, make the WNBA hot. The little Vogue cover for Angel Reese was everything. The women of the NCAA won the week. Thank you, Allie Velshi, Christina Greer, Susan DelPersio. Be sure to watch Allie's show, Velshi, tomorrow and Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern, as I do every week. And that is tonight's readout.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.